Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, newly released documents from a lawsuit filed against Fox News show that some of their personalities and executives may have knowingly promoted misinformation about the 2020 presidential election. We'll get the details. First, we recently received a question from Patricia Meyer from Beaver Dam as part of our Why Wisconsin project. She asked, I am curious about the history of railroads in Wisconsin, especially the early stages of rail transportation in the state. We want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Do you have questions about the history of trains in Wisconsin? What do you find interesting about trains, railroads, their history? Do you go to railroad museums, say? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Daniel Lidke is the curator at the National Railroad Museum in Green Bay. Daniel, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
When do we start to see the first railroads coming to Wisconsin?
Well, we started to see those actually into the 1850s. The year before Wisconsin became a state, the Milwaukee and Waukesha Railroad was chartered in 1847, but they didn't fully complete anything until 1851, and actually in that time they changed their name. It became the Milwaukee and Mississippi Railroad in 1850. And then on February 25th of 1851, we have our first train ride going from Milwaukee to Waukesha, and that was the first passenger train here in the state.
Yeah, when it comes to the early first couple decades of rail, was it more that kind of thing, passengers, or more freight, say agricultural products moving around and out of Wisconsin?
Yeah, it really was a combination of both. What was interesting, the railroad itself, that first one, Milwaukee and Mississippi, they started in February with that first passenger train, and already by April, they were hauling freight too. They had one passenger and one freight train that would run each day. And then right after that, you started having more railroads coming in. So the Chicago, Milwaukee, St. Paul, and Pacific, or what we typically call the Milwaukee Road, they came up and were forming in the 1850s. The Milwaukee and Mississippi really was kind of the precursor to that railroad. The Chicago Northwestern was coming up from Chicago in the 1850s also. And then you had some other Green Bay and Western in the 1870s, Northern Pacific later on. And really, the big thing was to meet the needs of transporting agricultural goods to the east. So a lot of the wheat, getting that moved to the east. And then really with the passenger side of things, that opened up the state really for Yankee settlers to come in. You know, before that, what you're really looking at with the territory and early statehood, you're looking at the waterways for your transportation. So this was a great way to transport yourself, really, if you're coming into the area for entrepreneurial things or just relocating, and also moved in with the immigrants. So it really opened up immigration, too, to the state.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Lou is with us in Ashland. Lou, hi.
Hey, good snowy day to everybody. Yeah, I'm a transport driver, and some of my passengers have said that the roads that intersect main roads, like, say, 13, the ones that are kind of at an angle that don't intersect and have sharp corners, and, you know, they'll come in kind of at an angle and then continue on the other side at an angle. And they often say that they are old railroad tracks. And I'm just wondering if there's any validity to that.
Oh, interesting. I had never heard that, Daniel. Do you know anything about that?
You know, and some of them may very well be. It's kind of interesting, especially when you're looking at early towns being developed in our area here in Green Bay. You had the French coming in first, then the British, then the Americans. So they all set up their cities differently. So some were making their plot lines, you know, connecting to the rivers, and some were making more of a grid system. So even here, our streets, all of a sudden you might be driving north-south one way and there's a bizarre angle because it was an old path, an old street. A lot of the railroads too, they had to kind of navigate some of those areas by rivers, by other geographic features. So they would try and get you know, as direct of route as possible, or the easiest route for laying the tracks. So some of those might be, I know too, when you're looking at some of those rails to trails things too, along the cities, those were all the old rail lines. So that they follow those too.
Thanks for the call, Lou, at 800-642-1234. Talking to Daniel Lidke from the National Railroad Museum in Green Bay, talking about Wisconsin's early railroad history, answering a Why Wisconsin question. We got another question from the UW-Madison Science Outreach Department on Twitter. They asked, I don't know if they're trying to stump us here, they asked, how did the railroad built in 1857 from Madison through what is today's UW-Madison campus and on to Prairie du Chien lead to the naming of the Camp Randall Stadium? I wonder if they know the answer and they're not letting on. I don't know, Daniel. Do you know anything about that part of the railroad history?
Well, and that's a great question, too. The Camp Randall itself, and I will immediately apologize to most of the callers here, most of the listeners. I am not big into sports, but I am into history. So the Camp Randall itself that I know more of the history of was the Camp Randall that was formed in 1861 to meet the needs of having a place for new recruits to go and get trained for the Civil War. So Camp Randall was actually named after Governor Randall of the state when he really, when Abraham Lincoln was pushing to get places to get recruits. So the Milwaukee, at that point, it was a Milwaukee and Mississippi Railroad. They did have a line coming into Wisconsin, or into Madison rather. So that was probably the way they were getting troops, new recruits in and out of there. The stadium then, I apologize, I want to say it was early 1900s, 1917. So they still had that rail line, the Milwaukee Road still had a rail line going through to Madison. And they ran trains going into Madison. They actually had into the 40s and 50s, there was a specific train that was going from Chicago to Madison. The Varsity, and that was bringing a lot of people to the games, especially on the weekends or holiday service to the games. So Camp Randall itself was named after the governor for the Civil War stuff, and then the stadium was named after the Civil War recruitment camp itself.
Excellent. Okay. And we also had a Wisconsin question in the past. You can find it at WPR.org on the role of Camp Randall in the Civil War. So you can find a little more about that. Can you talk some about, especially in the 1800s, you were starting to touch on this, how much trains changed our lives, our daily lives, our personal lives, where we chose to live if we were Wisconsinites in the second half of the 1800s?
Yeah, it's really interesting. I mean, with anything, when the railroads came through, regardless of what state it was, but specifically here in Wisconsin, when you're looking at the early railroads, with the first railroad, you know, got our first ride in 1851, you had about between 20 to 40 miles. And already by 1880, you've jumped from that 20-mile mark to having over 3,000 miles of rail in the state. So all the railroads coming through and investors in the railroads, entrepreneurs, you know, seeing the value of this new source of transportation, you know, and that continued well into the 1920s, really was the height of the industry. And then we see a decline, but you're bringing people in, not only for work, for, you know, building their new lives, for coming into the state. And then you're kind of getting into this, you know, what we think of more today with using the railroad for more leisure activities. So you've gone for it really being primarily the industry for moving moving goods or moving people, to starting to get it as more of transportation, vacations. Going back to the Camp Randall thing, sports trains, you had sports teams riding on these trains. You had it bringing people up to Green Bay for games, to Madison. So it really changes. Even hunting, there would be hunting excursions on these trains on the weekend going up to Loretta, up in Ashland County, Star Lake, Wisconsin. So you've got specific trains, Fisherman's Special in the Northwoods, Hiawatha, bringing people up to go hunting and fishing. So it really changed not only bringing people into the state, but how we moved around within the state.
In just our last minute or so, Daniel, can you share one of your favorite or most recent exhibits at the Railroad Museum? I've enjoyed visits there, and my kids certainly did a lot too.
Yeah, this is actually perfect because we have an exhibit right now called Rail Ties, and it's focusing on community stories. So it's really looking at people who either worked for the railroad or had families working for the railroad or had experiences that might be interested in telling us their story, to give oral histories here at the museum, or to, you know, if they want to loan an item and they have a neat story, whether it's a picture or an object, because we really want to preserve that history, both with the oral histories and the objects themselves. But we also want people to realize, you know, trains aren't just those things that you get stuck at by the crossing when you're watching all these freight cars go by. It had a huge impact and continues to have a huge impact on the state. So our newest exhibit, Rail Ties, really is trying to get that community engagement and involvement here with the museum, both now and continued.
And briefly, Daniel, if somebody says, yeah, I have a story or an artifact to share, are you still looking for those?
Yeah, absolutely. We started the exhibit at the beginning of the month here, but I'm going to be rotating things out throughout the year. And again, we always want those oral histories too. So any of those items, so they're welcome to contact me here at the museum.
Daniel, thanks again for joining us today.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me.
That's Daniel Lidke, curator at the National Railroad Museum based in Green Bay. He joined us to help answer a listener question for the Why Wisconsin Project about the history of trains in the state. We're done riding the rails, but come up, we'll hike and bike on them with a look at rails to trails projects here in the state and beyond. That's next on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We just learned about the history of trains in Wisconsin's early years. Staying on track, we're going to answer two more Wisconsin questions related to trains and railroads. Some railroad lines aren't railroads at all anymore, but we can still use them to get around. For some of those abandoned or otherwise removed railroads, they might get turned into a trail system. Typically referred to as a rail trail or rails to trails, these old railroads now offer a place for people to hike or bike. We recently received a couple of questions from John Hansen and Phil Kasnowski from Medford and from Madison. They asked, why was the first rail to trail in the nation developed in Wisconsin's Elroy Sparta area? History, people, groups to thank, how can it be expanded? And also about the history of the rails to trails and or other trails in the state. Earlier today, I got some answers to those questions with Eric Oberg, Midwest Regional Director of the Rails to Trails Conservancy. Eric, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Yes, thank you for having me.
Well, Wisconsin, pretty prominent figure in the rail to trail movement. We've got the first one, as I understand it, the Elroy Sparta Trail. How big a deal was this when this first rail to trail in the country got started?
Yeah, it was huge, right? The rail trail movement really started just a bit south of you guys in the Chicago suburbs. And there was a school teacher, Mary Thielgard Watts, in the 60s that wrote a letter to the editor posing the proposition that the railroad track in her community be turned into a place for people to get out and walk and have a place to go. And that really kickstarted it. Elroy Sparta became the first developed rail trail. It was really just a really good idea that happened to meet a perfect time. But it was a slow burn at the very beginning. It's not like it exploded right off the bat, but humble beginnings and in the Midwest, in Wisconsin, in Illinois.
Now, one of our Wisconsin question askers was curious about why that Elroy Sparta Trail, in fact, was converted into a trail. Was there something about that stretch that made it an attractive first developed trail?
Well, it's interesting, right? I mean, I'll start by saying that this movement started really slowly, you know, Elroy Sparta being the first one. And it took almost 20 years for Rail Trails Conservancy to be founded in 1986. And at that point, there was still only 250 miles of rail trail, which may sound like a lot, but today we have over 25,000 miles of rail trail. So what Elroy Sparta did was essentially prove the concept, right? And it was not the easiest thing. If any of your listeners that have been out there, it's the reason it's so wonderful. The tunnels are just unbelievable. But of course, tunnels and bridges are also big, expensive, and complicated pieces of infrastructure. So if you were to think about trying to create the first rail trail, while Elroy Sparta is undoubtedly one of the coolest and most beautiful, and those bridges and tunnels are awesome, they're also really difficult. So it wasn't the easiest, but it maybe it was the best. because it gave people that, you know, when you went out, the people that finally got to go out and see what a rail trail was like, if they went to Elroy Sparta, they were blown away, right? It's really cool. So it wasn't the easiest, but in hindsight, maybe it was the best.
Now, if you've ever tried to walk on a railroad track, it is not pleasant. Biking, less so, I imagine. What does it take? Can you talk about just the efforts to take a length of track, forget the tunnel and bridge for now, and turn it into a trail?
Well, you know, I'm not going to say it's easy, but I will say these corridors were engineered by, you know, the best and the brightest of their day, right? But these railroads really were the cutting edge of transportation when they were designed and engineered and built. So when you think about what they were built to do, to carry tons and tons of train and car, you know, of railroads and cargo, they make the perfect base for a walking and biking trail. And so you have a lot of the elements that you would need for a trail already in place, a wonderful substrate, you know, that all of that heavy rock and everything that they needed for a train is perfect for, it's over-engineered for a walking and biking trail. So it's just and maybe the most key thing about it, they also went from somewhere to somewhere, right? The railroads weren't building trails because they weren't building rail corridors because it was beautiful country and they just wanted to see neat things from the, you know, from the front of the train. The engineer didn't, they needed to get things from a place to a place. And that's the beauty of rail trails now. They certainly go through beautiful country, obviously, but they also connect people and communities because that's what the railroads did.
One of our Wisconsin listeners mentioned that within months of moving to Wisconsin, he felt like his local rail trail out of Medford encouraged him to explore his new city and go bike riding. Can you talk about the benefits and how this gets people in many communities outside?
Yeah, I love it. And one of my favorite, one of my favorite sentiments about rail trails was something that one of our founders at Rails to Trails Conservancy said, David Burwell. His dream was that rail trails would become America's main street. And that bit of nostalgia about what Main Street used to be, where, you know, families and people would be walking down Main Street and saying hi to each other. And it really was the place where community happened, right? And we've kind of driven, designed and suburbanized ourselves out of that Main Street community. And trails really have become, trails that go through around communities have become a place where community happens. And so that listener saying he gets on his bike and you know, really enjoys the community he's in, it's because that's where the community is. You're seeing young people, kids, families, old people. You're seeing folks walking, biking, mobility impaired with a wheelchair or otherwise. I mean, every facet of your community is out using that trail. And unlike in your car when you pass people, if you pass people on a trail, it is a personal experience. At the very least, you smile at each other. More often than not, you say hello. Maybe you stop to have a conversation. It's the place where community happens now.
Another listener question. A listener's curious to know if Wisconsin's current rail trails, including Elroy Sparta, could ever be expanded. Do you have your eyes on any trail expansions, especially in Wisconsin, in the works?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And I think that's one of the most exciting evolutions of the trail movement and really the evolution in the way that Rails to Trails Conservancy and our partners our work. We have gone from helping communities and states and otherwise develop individual trails, some of them really long, like Elroy Sparta. But because of the success of the movement in the last 50 years, we're now looking at connectivity. How do we connect these long trails to each other? How do we connect trails in more urban areas into networks that really allow people to move through these urban areas and get to get to places they want to go? And one of the great examples of that in Wisconsin is what we call the Route of the Badger. And Route of the Badger is one of our Trail Nation projects, a small suite of projects around the country that we are really trying to help prove this connectivity concept and show people how to do it and work with people on doing it. And Route of the Badger is in southeast Wisconsin. We're talking Milwaukee, Racine, Kenosha, Waukesha, where there's already 350 miles of amazing multi-use trail. And the goal of this project is to connect everything together into a 700-mile seamless network. And it's the number of nonprofit and public agency partners that have been working on this with us for years now is astounding, and the progress has been great. And when you look at a map of Wisconsin, there's, you know, there's a lot of metro areas where this connectivity work, you know, is already in progress, but there's also such huge potential for connecting some of the long distance corridors. If you stare at, if you look at a trail map of Wisconsin, a multi-use trail map, it is not at all hard to see that there's a real opportunity to connect the lake, you know, the lakefront in Milwaukee. It's almost all the way connected to Madison now. It's really, really close. And then from Madison, you can see that there's already some long distance trails, including the Elroy Sparta, that would eventually get you up to La Crosse. And think about a lake to river corridor from Milwaukee to La Crosse that that would cross the entire state of Wisconsin. What a amazing amenity for the people in Wisconsin, but also what an amazing amenity for people all over the world would come and use something like that.
Eric, we'll leave it there. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
That was Eric Oberg, Midwest Regional Director for Rails to Trails Conservancy. He talked with us about the history of rail to trail in Wisconsin and the Elroy Sparta Trail, the first one in the nation. This conversation came from multiple audience questions as part of our Why Wisconsin project. Do you want to know something? Something related to Wisconsin? Submit your question and we might tackle it in a future story. Go to WPR.org/WhySconsin. That's WHYSconsin. Coming up after the news, private messages from the personalities and executives at Fox News seem to contradict some of the network's reporting on the 2020 presidential election. We'll get the latest details from a defamation lawsuit filed against the network. I'm Rob Ferret. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time here on the Ideas Network. Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, North Korea has launched a new round of missile tests and a new round of threats. We'll get the latest on U.S. relations with North and South Korea. Now, emails and texts from Fox News executives and personalities seem to directly contradict some of the news organization's own coverage of the 2020 presidential election. The messages released last week come from a defamation lawsuit filed by Dominion Voting Systems seeking $1.6 billion in damages. Dominion says these messages show that Fox News kept broadcasting untrue information because they feared losing viewers. In its defense, Fox News says that its reporting and commentary were legitimate news-gathering activities protected under the First Amendment. Our next guest has been following the lawsuit and the inner workings of Fox News. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you watch Fox News? Do you watch the news part of it, the commentary part in the evenings? What's your opinion of their reporting and their talk show hosts? When should a media outfit be liable if they are reporting false information, if they're doing it knowingly? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Eric Wemple is the media critic for The Washington Post. Eric, welcome to Central Time.
Hey, thanks for having me. Delighted to be here.
Can you briefly bring us up to speed on this Dominion Voting Systems lawsuit against Fox News?
Of course. Yes, it was in 2021, early 2021, when Dominion Voting Systems filed this lawsuit against Fox News. The lawsuit relates to a bunch of statements made on the air at Fox News, basically in the weeks after the 2020 presidential election, statements in which Fox News guests and hosts said stuff about the 2020 election, allegations that it was stolen, of course, repeating President Trump's claims. And in many of these cases, they sort of swept in a conspiracy theory that voting machines that were made by Dominion Voting Systems, a U.S. firm, were used to flip votes from President Trump to President Biden. There was also a lot of chatter that Smartmatic, which makes software also for voting systems and other voting technology, was involved in the same sort of racket. In all cases, just about all cases, the representations about these two voting firms on Fox News were false. And both of the voting firms sued for big money. I believe it was $1.6 billion for Dominion and more for Smartmatic. But it was, it's this idea that they basically defamed these two companies by making false and damaging statements about their business. And the claim is that these businesses are irreparably harmed into the future as a result.
Now, here we are here we are with this this brief from Dominion Voting Systems, and their case are revealing a lot of what they saw in internal communications behind the scenes at Fox News. This is executives, this is on-air hosts, news department, and more. There's a lot here. What struck you the most in seeing what Dominion had included in this brief?
Well, what struck me most was that finally someone had pierced the veil of Fox News. For years, reporters and lawsuits, lawyers and so on and so forth have tried to get behind the scenes to find out what was really going on there. This is the most intrusive look at Fox News, the most insightful sort of discovery venture legally that's ever been done at Fox News as far as I can see. And what struck me the most was simply what struck just about everybody was the fact that the Fox News hosts and executives who were allowing these falsehoods to be aired on Fox News, well, they didn't believe them. It's one thing under U.S. libel law to say false things that you believe, in other words, just to make honest mistakes, but these were not honest mistakes. These were dishonest mistakes, according to this brief. And this is the brief that we're talking about just a week ago. It comes from it comes after months of discovery in which Fox News had to turn over texts and emails and documents to Dominion.
Now, the motivation here is interesting from the journalistic side of this. There's kind of a legal and a journalistic side here. Again and again, some of these executives and hosts are looking at Fox viewers after Fox calls Arizona for Joe Biden. And in other instances, viewers, according to the ratings, moving over to Newsmax and One America News, which had no reservations about sharing a lot of these conspiracy theories. What was the response from executives and hosts to that loss of viewers and how they tried to, I think the phrase thread the needle kept coming up?
Yeah, it was panic. It was panic. Look, the thing about Fox News is that ever since 2002, early 2002, when they became the number one cable news outlet as measured by ratings, it's something they've just been touting and bragging about and trumpeting every single day. It is their identity. Ratings is their identity. If they did not have ratings, they would not have much to fall back on because they don't come up with a lot of scoops. They're basically, as you suggested in the beginning, a talk show network. And so if they're not pulling down the ratings, they don't have much. So when they started seeing viewers who wanted to see this stolen election narrative, when they started to see those viewers desert them because Fox News was giving too much of the real story, they panicked. And the threading the needle, what that is all about, is trying to not defame people and trying not to go over too far out on the edge, but while at the same time leaving open this possibility that, yeah, Donald Trump really did get screwed in the election. There was electoral fraud and much. It's just trying to play this middle game and trying to appease both sides. And that was obviously disastrous.
We're talking to Eric Wemple, media critic for The Washington Post, looking at documents released in this lawsuit from Dominion Voting Systems against Fox News for defamation. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts. If you've been following this, your questions, 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller. Mike is with us in Sun Prairie. Mike, hi.
Hi.
What did you want to bring up, Mike?
Well, I think that Fox News should be held accountable the same way that Donald Trump should be held accountable for the lies that he perpetrated the entire time that he was in office.
Mike, thanks for the call. Eric, let's talk about some of the legal side of this. The bar for, and you're starting to touch on this, the bar for holding a news outlet accountable for something like defamation, it's pretty high. Based on what we've seen in past cases, high-profile cases, what do we have to prove to say, yeah, this news outlet owes money to this person they, or in this case, this business they've defamed?
Right. Well, for the purposes of this case, the judge has ruled that Dominion is basically a public figure for the purposes of defamation law. And that's a term of art that's proprietary to defamation law. And it means that if you are a public figure, you have a very difficult time of proving damages and getting damages in a defamation action. The public figure standard was crafted by the Supreme Court back in the 60s in 1964, basically with the notion that, hey, if you are out there exposing yourself to public scrutiny as a politician, you shouldn't be able to just like go and sue every media outlet that makes an accidental mistake. Right? That the mistake has to be willing, somehow like a knowing or willing falsehood, or it has to be reckless disregard, which under the law, which under this doctrine is very hard to prove. So the idea here is that this is the sort of law that enables us in the United States to have a real, really kind of an open, no holds barred public discourse. And you don't have to worry about Bill Clinton or Hillary Clinton or Donald Trump, whatever, suing you every time you make a disparaging comment about them that could be false. In other words, falsehoods about people who invite scrutiny are okay, but knowing damaging falsehoods against those people are not okay. So that the latter basket is what Dominion has to prove here, has to prove that Fox not only said damaging false things, but they did so with a certain state of mind.
Right. There's a case where Sarah Palin, former Alaska governor, had sued the New York Times, which in a column did make a false statement about her that could be read certainly as disparaging. They did it once. They corrected it. They did an apology the next day. What looks different in the case that Dominion is presenting from a case like that, which ultimately was unsuccessful?
Yeah, ultimately what the jury ruled against Palin, and this, by the way, is a great example, and you've abridged it 100% correctly. The difference here, I think the main difference, is the Times thing was one-off, right? This was one editorial that was written, I believe, in June 2017. One editorial, a few sentences, boom. And that's all it was. And there was a correction. And when Palin got the New York Times to give up their emails and their correspondence, text messages, and so on and so forth, it revealed that these people made a mistake, that they screwed up, that they said that Sarah Palin, that this person who had engaged in the rampage was completely in his own world, his own delusional world, and was not connected to anything that Sarah Palin may have planted in his head through Pat and her super PAC or whatever. But this stuff with Dominion is repeated. I mean, one of the reasons why these complaints from these two voting technology companies are so long, they're hundreds and hundreds of pages, is because there's so much material there. Fox News did this repeatedly. The number of allegedly defamatory statements is marathonic. So that is, I would say that's the major difference here, which is the volume. Major difference between Fox, the Dominion case and the Palin case is the volume of allegedly defamatory statements. And I think the amount of sheer evidence in the latest filing about what Fox knew about the situation ahead.
Eric Wemple. Eric Wemple is with us, media critic at The Washington Post, looking at behind-the-scenes documents from Fox News revealed in a defamation lawsuit filed by the voting machine company Dominion. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have these revelations changed your opinion of Fox News or reinforced it? What questions do you have? Join in at 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk with Eric Wempel, media critic for The Washington Post, looking at recent revelations from Dominion Voting Systems' defamation lawsuit against Fox News over the aftermath of the 2020 election and why some Fox News personalities were broadcasting claims that behind the scenes they said were not true. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts. That's 800-642-1234. Just one example here. I want to give a listen to Fox News host Sean Hannity on his TV show. This is November 30th of 2020, talking with Donald Trump's attorney, Sidney Powell.
I've gone over everything I've been able to find out. Nobody liked Dominion Voting Systems. Nobody. Has anybody forensically examined these machines since the election?
We have only been allowed access to a few of them. We've got evidence of corruption all across the country in countless districts. They used the machines to trash large batches of votes that should have been awarded to President Trump.
So a big claim there and often heard on Fox News in that era, according to these filings. What were Fox News personalities saying about Sidney Powell, herself, her sources, and her claims?
Well, behind the scenes, they were saying complete BS. And worse, they were saying, you know, just she's nuts, BS, nothing to them, baseless allegations. But they had her on over and over again, and they were careful, you know, once in a while. And Fox lawyers have made this point. Once in a while, they asked her to supply evidence, and Tucker Carlson said, you know, we need to see evidence from you. He was possibly the most skeptical toward her, but she kept on getting on. And other people who were also, you know, trading in this sort of talk were on all the time. Dominion and Smartmatic were mentioned in this vein. And the statements, you know, that were made were really damning towards Fox News, even if they don't get a lot of money out of a jury award or a settlement or whatever. Journalistically, this is I mean, it's a major scandal for Fox News. Of course, there's a major scandal, it seems, for Fox News every month. So,
yeah, one of the weirdest bits, Eric, when asked for information, Sidney Powell provided an email to one of the shows quoting one of her sources here. This is a source for some of Sidney Powell's claims in the election. I'm quoting here. Who am I and how do I know all of this? I've had the strangest dreams since I was a little girl. I was internally decapitated, and yet I live. The wind tells me I'm a ghost, but I don't believe it. And the source goes on to say she can get information because she can, quote, time travel in a semi-conscious state, end quote.
Yep. That's a source document, right? That's a source document. If that counts as a source document at Fox News. So, you know, in the filing, you see that, you know, I think it was Bartiromo or one of the other hosts was saying, you know, obviously that was complete garbage, but, you know, doesn't seem to matter. You know, when you don't have standards for your journalism or your news reports day in and day out, you know, when a crunch time comes, like this is really crunch time for this network. Everything can go, you know, everything goes right out the window. So this is really remarkable. I think that even for people like myself, I've been covering Fox News for more than a decade and a lot of others, you know, this was even shocking to us.
Let's go back to our callers. Kay is with us in Madison. Kay, hello.
Hi, how you doing? I think I'm timely on this. I can give you, I'm a real source. I'm not decapitated. I'm a live person. And I worked in New York City elections for several years on, and because I have a computer background, I was in charge of the scanning machines. It was the first time I started from the first, we got this Midwestern firm. I don't know whether it's Dominion, but I assume most of them run by scanning. Anyway, so there was only one box at the bottom for the good ballots. So people put their ballot in, it scanned it, it gave it a number, it dropped in the locked box that had been examined at the beginning of the day to make sure there were no papers in there. It never was unlocked. At the end of the night, I and a police officer witnessed me pulling the box out that it was locked. I handed the box to the police officer. I was the only one who touched it. He and I both signed a form that we had both received it, that I had handed it to him, and I took that form home. So I consider that kind of misreporting also defamation to me, endangerment perhaps to me in future elections, and harassment.
Okay, thanks for the call. General harassment of election workers, Kay is worried about. If there were specific election workers who were targeted by a media outlet, would a different standard apply? Would they be considered public figures in this kind of case, Eric, in a hypothetical lawsuit by somebody like Kay who felt they'd been targeted?
Yeah, well, like certainly the media defense firm would try to bootstrap them into public figures. And there is a pretty broad and liberal category called limited purpose public figures. And those are people who have sort of thrown themselves into some controversy. But it's really, really, it would be really, really hard to make the case that a campaign, elections night volunteer would be a public figure. I think that that person would remain a private figure throughout. It's an interesting sort of formulation. It's an interesting process for deciding that, but you really have to want to be in the public limelight. That is sort of like you need to expect to be in the limelight. I don't think an elections night volunteer would.
Okay, thanks a lot for sharing that. Yordis joins us next in Colfax. Yordis, hello.
Hello. I think Dominion has every right to sue because this is their business and they have been defamed. I mean, these lies that were perpetuated constantly by Fox could kill their business, destroy it. And that is jobs for people. It also insults everyone that works for that company as if there are people inside manipulating and doing trickery to create false votes. And it's an attack on democracy, ultimately. And these people, they don't have a conscience at Fox. They don't have a conscience. It's shocking.
Yordis, thanks for the call. Yordis making the point that Dominion isn't just arguing that Fox was knowingly wrong, but that it did substantial monetary damage to them. That's part of the story. The part of the case they're making, Eric.
Is that a question for me?
Yeah.
Oh, yes. Right. The Dominion is saying that there are damages relating to their future business and so on and so forth. I think that the most convincing part of the Fox argument is that the damages, the Dominion is having trouble to proving all these damages. Now, the damages part can get really, really complicated with all sorts of different sorts of damage, presumed damage, actual damage, punitive damages, so on and so forth. It gets really complicated. But the nub of the Fox News argument is that this company is worth like tens of millions of dollars, not even worth $100 million. So the idea that they could be claiming $1.6 billion as a damages claim, as a total damages claim, is just ridiculous. I don't think anybody out there really thinks that there's going to be a $1.6 billion forked over at any point. But it is the $1.6 billion, I think, does represent how huge the journalistic outrages and atrocities are.
Thanks for that call. Just in our last half a minute or so, Eric, does it matter for the future of Fox? Are Fox's followers going to look at this and say, we hate this deception, or are they going to stick with the network, do you think?
That's a great question to end on. For years and years and years, people are always tempted to say, this could be the undoing of Fox, or this could really bring Fox down, something like that. My default has always been never, ever to overblow anything that happens at Fox on the scandalous side, because they are rugged. They can bounce back from anything. In fact, you could make the argument that all the scandals they've endured over the years, all the scandals that they themselves have generated, have boosted viewership. And that whenever you find, you know, outlets like Wisconsin Public Radio, Washington Post, you know, outlets that are associated with mainstream and establishment causes, hammering Fox, that only helps their audience. We're stuck with Fox. This can be a big embarrassment for them. It could mean some changes to how they operate, but Fox will be Fox.
Thanks to our guest, Eric Wemple, media critic for The Washington Post, looking at internal discussions that took place at Fox News, how those discussions appear to contradict some of their own reporting about the 2020 presidential election. Coming up tomorrow on The Morning Show, relief efforts in Wisconsin for the Turkey and Syria earthquake.